Good morning, and welcome to WGTD's Community Matters. I'm Laura Sumner Kuhn, your host this morning, and I'm so glad that I can bring to you today two guests who will really deepen our understanding of some of the issues that we're facing at a critical time in our history. With me today is Jeremy Triblett, the founder of Jeremy Triblett LLC. Jeremy has some very interesting work and important work for us all. He works in diversity, equity, and inclusion, and it began with work he did at Marquette University, and he developed something called the Microaggression Game Training. It uses scenario-based learning to help participants understand how marginalized people might interpret, internalize, and react to daily subtle slights and insults. Jeremy is a perfect guest for us on this show, where for the last few months, we've been looking at how to recognize racism. And Jeremy happens to be an expert that is being brought to our community by the Racine Women for Racial Justice. Kelly Scoggins-Powell is another one of our guests this morning. About a year ago, we had a discussion on this very show with Kelly and Mary Pucci, who were co-founders of a Facebook page that just wanted to bring together women of all different ethnic and diverse backgrounds and racial backgrounds to discuss living together in this Racine community. And what began as conversations exploded with the murder of George Floyd last summer. It's appropriate that this week we're talking about these issues since Derek Chauvin's murder trial, the officer who is accused of murdering George Floyd, is ongoing right as we are airing the show this week. And it was that instigation that prompted Mary and Kelly to consider how many more women, there were about 800, who wanted to have these discussions at that time. And the idea for becoming a full-blown nonprofit organization to address these issues grew. And at this time, the Racine Women for Racial Justice is a nonprofit organization that Kelly is now the executive director of, and Mary Pucci is the chairperson. And they are actually bringing Jeremy Triblett to the community over the next two Saturdays. Actually, it's a three-Saturday program, but the first of which is happening as we air this show this week. But there will be two other opportunities on April 17th and April 24th from 10 to noon to participate in Jeremy's microaggression game training to get a deeper understanding and some tools to use to learn how not to be somebody who uses microaggressions, somebody who is the recipient of microaggressions, to learn how to understand how to react, give them tools to react, and especially for allies or bystanders to help intervene to recognize when these situations are occurring. So with that in mind, I am delighted to have Jeremy and Kelly with us this morning. And Jeremy, if you could start by explaining to us what microaggressions are and how you came to develop this training.
Thank you for inviting me here, Laura, and I thank Kelly as well for inviting me. I'm just excited to start this conversation, and I'm excited to have the community engaged in it. One of the things we talk about a lot is that when you're having conversations like these and you get uncomfortable, it's because you care, right? And so when we talk about microaggressions, folks get uncomfortable because of the definition in and of itself. The definitions are the everyday slights, insults, put downs and validations, or even offensive behaviors that target certain people in everyday interactions, right? And a lot of people who do who are microaggressive, they don't may not even realize they are being microaggressive. They may have really good intentions. It may be how they were raised. They may have thoughts or ideas about people based off of, you know, the church they go to, the people they hang around, the beliefs they have. And they don't know that they need to unlearn those things, because not only is it inaccurate, but it could actually cause harm to other people.
Jeremy, how did you come to develop this game? What is it that made you become an actor of change for our communities?
You know what? I actually began my work and as a youth organizer. We used to do work with young people in Milwaukee, where I'm born and raised, and we would do stuff like cop watches. We would do stuff like go to Madison and testify for different bills that were being passed. We even encouraged adults to vote, right? And so I have a long history of just organizing and finding ways to interject conversations around race and equity and justice into everything, right? I actually grew up on 35th and Hampton. And on 35th and Hampton, it's mostly African American. A lot of us didn't have really high income. And we had a whole bunch of police officers that would kind of patrol the streets. And one night I'm in my car driving down the street, about two blocks away from the house. And I notice a police officer gets behind me. And if you've ever been pulled over unjustly or pulled over a lot, you can almost feel when they're about to pull you over. And I could feel it that night. I had it in my gut. So about one block away from my house, they turned the high beam on. I drive into my driveway. I step onto my grass, and it seems like clowns coming out of a car. It seemed like so many officers. But it was about four or five of them in reality. They come up to me on my grass. One of them stands in front of me, shines his light in my eyes, and he asks the other officers, "Is this him?" They say, "Nope, it's not him." I can finally breathe. They get back in their car and they drive away. Now, somebody would say, "Well, at least you didn't get shot, Jeremy." Somebody would say, "At least they didn't tase you." Somebody would say, "At least they didn't interrogate you." Somebody else would say, "Well, at least they didn't unlawfully detain you." But the truth of the matter is, when they showed up to my doorstep and they put that light in my face, they also did something to me that they do to a lot of people, and it seems subtle. They never actually asked me who I was. They never asked me a word. That is inhumane. That strips me of my identity and my presence in the world. I felt like it wasn't about me as a human being. It was all about them and what their mission was. That's microaggressive. That slight, that put down, that invalidation of my experience. From then on, I began to not only research cops and what it means to be on patrol and continuously advocate against police brutality, but I also understood that language matters, right? In instances like that, where everybody else is looking and going, "Well, at least it wasn't worse," we have to understand those everyday small cuts add up. And folks like me who have what we call marginalized identities, identities where people are saying, "We don't want to hear from you," identities that say, "We don't have to service you at this restaurant," identities that say, "We don't care which bathroom you go into," identities that say, "Historically, we've oppressed you and we don't plan on making any amends for it." Folks who share those kind of identities, we encounter stuff like this every day. And it can be real hard to prove that something was done incorrectly, but we know it because we live it. And so for me, microaggression was that word, was that concept that really captured those everyday experiences for me.
As I think about microaggressions that you've described, and that doesn't seem like such a subtle example, that one. Flagrant violation of humanity. But microaggressions can be very, very subtle, and in my understanding. And there are many roles that people play as a microaggression is happening. Could you take us through those roles that people might find themselves in during a microaggression experience and walk through a little bit each of those players, if you were to consider this in your game? You know, what are those roles and what happens in each of those identities of people participating in a microaggression?
So the first thing I'll say is I'll break down a little bit of what the concept of the game is, and then I'll talk to you all a little bit more about microaggression and the roles we play. So in this game, it is really built off of Dr. Wing Tzu. He did a report on about 2,000 people of color, and him and his team determined that there is a cycle that people go through whenever we experience microaggressions. And within that cycle, we interpret a microaggression as in when I hear you say something like, you're beautiful for a black woman. You think you're giving me a compliment, right? You would think that a black woman would be like, thank you so much, I appreciate it. But for black women, they may actually interpret that as, you think black women are ugly, except for me. And so in that slight wording, we can see that there's a history of calling black women ugly, especially when they have darker skin. And we can see how, based off how that person used the compliment, it can be a direct reflection of how they see other black women. Instead, if you want to call a black woman pretty or beautiful or whatever, just call her pretty. Just call her beautiful. Doesn't have to be in context of other people, right? So you interpret things. It's important for us in this game to recognize not only what a microaggression is. To me, that's the easy part. But you also want to recognize when it is happening, how people interpret it. That's going to open up a conversation. And you're going to go, wow, I didn't realize you heard that in that way. Yeah. You also want to realize how people are internalizing it. People feel small. Sometimes they feel angry. Other times they feel invisible. Sometimes they even just become compliant. They just do what they got to do. They act like they agree when really they're hurt and they're offended because we're trying to survive, right? And so not only do we interpret what somebody is doing to us, but we may internalize a belief about ourselves because we keep experiencing this. And then the last thing we talk about in the game is reaction, right? That is, how are folks responding? Sometimes you may be microaggressive towards somebody, and they like, listen, I'm going to call you out about it, right? And they let you know, they read you your rights, they check you on spot. But then there's other times where somebody may actually try to help you out, right? They'll try to smooth it over, act like it doesn't offend them, or they'll try to give you an excuse and say something like, oh, I know you didn't mean it, right? Or I know what you were trying to say, right? And so we call that rescuing the offender. And so in this game, people assume four different teams. And all you're doing is you're just listening to a scenario and you're trying to correctly match what that person's reaction was, how they internalized it, and how they interpreted the microaggression. And if you do it right, you earn the status of an interventionist. If you do it wrong, you earn the status of a bystander. Okay? So that's pretty much the layout of the game. Now, you asked another question. You wanted to know more about, in the moment, what are those roles people can play? I just described to you how folks respond, interpret, and internalize, but now I want to change the conversation for you. Now I want to talk about in an everyday situation, who are these, like, what role can we play when a microaggression is happening? And I'll break that down for you right now. There are four different people you can be at the moment you realize a microaggression is happening. You could be the initiator, right? That person could be sharing a meme or a GIF that is completely stereotypical, offensive, or it doubled down on a false belief about certain people. Or you could be referring to people groups in stereotypical terms or real general ways, right? Saying stuff like, that's so gay of you. That's offensive. You don't want to call someone who's not gay gay. You don't want to assume that somebody is acting in a homosexual way, all of that kind of stuff, right? So we even have these microaggressive terms that we use to refer to other people. That is called an initiator, the person who basically does the microaggression. But then there's the instigator. Have you ever seen somebody being harming somebody, saying something flippantly to somebody, and then the instigator is laughing in the background? the instigator is high-fiving people, or the instigator is excusing them, saying, oh, it's not that serious, they didn't mean it that way. That's the instigator. But then you got two other people. You got the bystander. That's the person who chooses to be silent. They see the person who initiated the microaggression. They ain't do nothing. They are watching the person who is standing by and instigating the situation, and they're still doing nothing. They're just kind of there, trying not to be seen, trying not to be involved. But then there's the interventionist, and this is the person this training helps everybody to become. When you're done with this training, you're going to be able to address bias in individuals directly. You're going to be able to identify the biases in yourself. You're going to be able to have more robust conversations about bias and figure out small, subtle, and sometimes obvious ways of intervening microaggressions.
Without giving too much away, Jeremy, can you give us one tool that seems to be a pretty common an easy to use tool to be an interventionist that people can have with them in the back of their minds when they're in a situation when they are uncomfortable because they know that something is unjustly happening?
Yeah, sure. So a lot of times when microaggressions are occurring, there's folks who don't even realize it's happening, and then there's people who do. Right. I want to speak to the people who actually know, like, you know what, this seems microaggressive. For that person, you have two options. You can intervene at that moment. And something you could start off by saying is, wait just a moment. I don't want what you're saying to be misinterpreted. Can you clarify? Many times people are totally willing. Everybody wants to be heard. And if I'm saying something that's offensive to you, sometimes you can help me check myself by saying, hey, Jeremy, did you want to clarify that? What you're saying could be misinterpreted. So the first tool is to figure out how to get a better understanding. Let's say there's somebody who doubles down on what they're saying, right? The second thing you can do is say, you know what? I respect what you're saying, but it is also really offensive. I'm not sure if you're trying to offend me or if you're trying to get your point across. And so the second thing I tell folks is when we're having conversations, you want to help everybody distinguish what the intention is versus what the impact is. And so you may have intended to say what you feel, but your impact is you're being offensive, you're being hurtful, you're silencing other people. So if you're trying to say what you feel, can we do that differently? And so you may tell a person, hey, right now you are triggering me. Right now, use those words. Right now, I'm feeling like you're not hearing me. At this moment, what you're doing seemed a little bit microaggressive. Can we take a step back? Right? And so you can always say, listen, here's how what you're doing is impacting me right now in the moment. And then offer that person to take a step back if you can. Can we cut the conversation? Can we regather ourselves, right? All of those things. And then the last tool I'll give is that you always want to be prepared to talk about your why. You know, as a person who lives with marginalized identities, maybe you're LGBTQ, maybe you're a woman, maybe you're African American or Asian American. It is not our job to educate folks on their biases, right? But one of the things we can do is talk about why what they're doing is offensive to us individually, right? I'm not asking you to become a textbook definition of anything or to offer a sermon or a college course on why that person's offensive. Let them do that research. What you want to focus on is why you were offended. Sometimes folks need to just hear what you're saying, right? And so those are three things we could definitely do in the moment when we see a microaggression happening. And those three things really largely depend on if the person is listening and if they have a open ear to hear what your perspective is.
You bring up a really good point that the person who is the marginalized person in this scenario could be exhausted by having this happen continually. Yep. What kinds of tools or protections do you talk about in your training to offer them to feel more empowered? You mentioned just a little bit of it a minute ago. You know, it's not that person's responsibility to educate everybody. But are there some other ways of protecting yourself or empowering yourself when you're in a situation and you're the recipient of that microaggression?
You know, during the training, we talk a lot about different interventions, and they're actually based off of the scenarios that we offer. And so in the training, when you show up to it, you're going to find 5 different scenarios that really clue you in onto 5 major buckets of microaggressions. And for each one in the training, we process why it was problematic, and then we process what you could do about it. And so I'm going to actually save those pieces for folks who show up in the training, because I really want to make sure they can grab something from it, and that these conversations are fresh for people once they show up. So I'm going to actually challenge folks to take those 3 steps that I gave you earlier, but then also participate in the training, because this learning is 10 times much more powerful when you have the lived experiences and the collective learning of other folks engaged.
I can appreciate that. I'm going to take to remind our listeners that they're listening to WGTD's Community Matters. And today's show, we have guest Jeremy Triblett from Jeremy Triblett LLC, who is describing his microaggression game training that is coming to our community thanks to the Racine Women for Racial Justice, a nonprofit organization that is having this 3-week training session that will include April 17th and April 24th from 10 a.m. to noon, and it's all virtual. I'd like to take this opportunity now to invite Kelly Scoggins-Powell into the conversation. Kelly is the executive director of the Racine Women for Racial Justice. And this is a fairly new organization formed just in the last year. Kelly, could you describe for us, first of all, how you knew about Jeremy and his training and why you think it's so important for our community to experience?
You know, first of all, Laura, I want to say thank you for creating this space for us to kind of inform people about the microaggressions training, and to thank Jeremy for bringing it to the Racine community. You know, as we continue to engage in this anti-racist work, I think we have learned that there are so many situations in which Black Indigenous people of color are impacted by racism. You know, often we focus on the systemic racism and the institutional racism, but a very real lived daily experience is the frequent occurrences of microaggressions. And oftentimes the perpetrators are unaware that they are, you know, using microaggressive statements, and more importantly, the impact that it has on the marginalized people. Those marginalized people are forced to deal with these microaggressive encounters in the workplace, in the community, everywhere that they go. And so we know that it is important for us as an organization to bring this awareness and this education to the Racine community, because our hope is to be able to reduce or actually eliminate the negative impacts of those microaggressions.
We've talked a little bit about microaggressions from a role level, but maybe you could share with us some further examples of microaggressions that people might face in the workplace. and what kind of complications that brings up for people who are working together that might go unspoken or unseen? What kind of ramifications personally and organizationally have evolved from that?
Yeah, you know, one of the microaggressive statements that I personally and so many other people of color that I have talked to have experienced are statements like, "Wow, you're very articulate." You know, it's almost as if they're surprised. Because you are.
I get the same thing all the time.
All the time. It's like a common statement. People, they act like they're surprised that you're intelligent. They act like they're surprised that you can use correct grammar. And whereas, like Jeremy said, the person who was saying it to me, they really think that they're giving me a compliment. But what they do not understand, what they're really saying is, I really think most Black people are not articulate. Most Black people are not intelligent. And so I'm surprised or amazed at the difference in you. And so the perpetrator, that's how we receive it. So it's not a compliment. I'm sorry, the person that's receiving it, you know, it's not a compliment to us, but the difficulty becomes in getting the perpetrator to understand that even though you intended for it to be a compliment, it was really harmful. And that is a tough place to be in because people will push back and they will say, "I didn't mean any harm. No, I'm not a racist. How dare you say that to me?" Totally unwilling to listen to what the person who has been offended is saying to them and be willing to consider that even though it was well-intended, it is yet harmful. And when people fail to do that, then we see a continuation of these microaggressive encounters in the workplace. So then the person who is encountering it, they have several choices that they have to make in that moment. And that's when it can become problematic for us. Because of course, if you respond in that moment, then you're labeled as angry, that you're making a big deal out of nothing. He or she is too emotional, or worse yet, your coworkers say things like, you make them feel uncomfortable. They feel intimidated by you. No one really giving ear to the fact that it started with a microaggression. And so then people are put in a position where they say nothing. And so now they're in an uncomfortable work atmosphere where daily they are encountering microaggressions and they feel as though they cannot give voice because their job might actually be on the line. And that in and of itself can be very emotionally draining. It can be very unnerving for people. And unfortunately, people of color live it every single day.
Yeah, the personal toll must be tremendous in a situation as you've described, and then not only from that personal standpoint of having to bear that burden continually, but even on the level of using all of your talents in your workplace as you would want to seems to be stymied just by that veil of oppression that you feel. Is that what you're hearing people describe, that they're not then, they step back not to live out what they'd love to do in their workplaces because of this continual burden of oppression that they feel from the microaggressions that surround them? Am I characterizing that right? Does that happen then?
You know, I think so, you know, and I think Jeremy can even, you know, speak to that as well, because I think what it does is the person who is experiencing the microaggression in the workplace, they show up every day in a space where they feel devalued, they feel dehumanized, they feel as though they don't have a voice, and that can be a difficult space to work at your fullest capacity, to use all of your skill and talent when every day you're walking under the burden of feeling like, what's the next microaggression that I'm going to encounter and feel forced to deal with, you know, or if I make a choice to say something, will people really hear and understand what I'm saying, you know? And as a result, again, people are not saying anything, and they're carrying this burden, and it's affecting every part of their lives, you know? And so it is difficult to show up in a workplace and do your best when you don't feel valued.
Yeah, I can add to that for sure. One of the things I tell folks is, especially when I'm doing this training in organizations, is that in actuality, it's less about if someone feels like they're walking up against microaggressions at work, right? We oftentimes focus on the big questions. Do people at this job, at this organization, feel like they're being microaggressed against, right? And what people don't realize is when people go to work and they endure all kinds of microaggressions, it's because they're trying to feed their family. Nobody really wants to tell you the truth if they feel like it could risk their jobs. And so there are a lot of employers who aren't getting the truth. They're not getting the truth because there's something called a power dynamic. They're the employer, they hold the check, they have the ability to hire and fire. And so people show up at work, even if it's a great place to be, people show up with a level of self-protection and survival because it's their jobs, right? And so what I tell folks all the time, especially C-suite clients of mine or executive level groups, board members, is that we don't want to create an interview process in a sense where people have to do all of this disclosing if you haven't done the work to change the culture in the organization first. Because now, not only have I been going to an organization who has been microaggressive, but now the people who are doing it want me to tell them that they're doing it. And so what I tell folks is to take a step back first. Let's assume that there is power and privilege in this institution. Let's show up with that assumption, right? And then after that, let's do the work of acknowledging that power and privilege. Why don't you go back and talk with other executive directors who have been doing this work longer than you. Find credible consultants who can help you identify your blind spots and your microaggressive policies potentially. And then tell folks, listen, y'all, the reason why we're doing this work today is because we realize we have been doing some things that may have been microaggressive. For that, we want to apologize or recognize it, right? Do that work first. That way you don't put the burden on the person who is being employed to have to actually come up with reasons why scenarios win and still feel comfortable in that work environment.
Wow.
Excellent. Yeah.
You know, Laura, if I could just jump in there, you know, and that's one of the reasons why we reached out to Jeremy to come to do that training. Because as you know, Racine Women for Racial Justice, we have a private Facebook group for our members. And even within the posting within the social media page, we see almost on a regular basis, microaggressive comments and posts that are made probably by well-meaning people. And then when that microaggression is called out, what we see are white women, you know, being offended, feeling as though they're being attacked, feeling as though people don't understand. That's not what they meant. They make it all about them. And like Jeremy said, we have learned that even when we say or we try to explain, people are not hearing it from us because we're too connected to the group. We're too connected to the work. So we thought, what better way than to bring an outside consultant, a professional in this field, to work with all of us to help us gain a new level of competency and understanding around it without feeling like Kelly is picking on me, Kelly doesn't like me, Kelly is always saying something to me when I make these posts. No, we're going to bring a professional outside consultant who can help all of us be able to recognize, you know, when this is happening, and hopefully to hold us accountable to a place where there will be real transformation and change, but also to empower the people, the marginalized people who are receiving these aggressions, to say, no, you're not crazy. No, you're not over emotional. These experiences are real. But now here are some tools that even you can use in those moments that will help people understand and, you know, identify and understand what they're doing, but also help you cope and be able to deal with it and be able to mitigate, you know, the impact on you personally as the marginalized person.
Such important work, Kelly. Thanks for expanding on that need for microaggression training. And this should be an ongoing experience. It isn't one training is going to fix anything. What kind of reaction, Jeremy, have you gotten from organizations and corporations that you've worked with? What do people find once they've gone through at least the initial training? What kinds of results have you seen from it?
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for asking that. I mean, you know, the responses are definitely different for folks of color than they are for folks who are white. And so the first thing that comes to mind is that folks of color are saying, finally. You know, we go through a lot of amazing diverse equity and inclusion trainings, and trainings about race and trainings about microaggressions, but few times do folks explore the impact of microaggressions from the perspective of the person who is the victim of it. And so a lot of people of color and people with marginalized identities are going, this is the language I've been looking for. Yes, you're confirming the experiences I couldn't explain. That's powerful. That is powerful. Many folks get exhausted because they're already living these trainings out. And so it kind of feels like we're like digging up a whole bunch of wounds that nobody is offering concrete ways to heal, right? And so folks of color are going, yup, I ain't got to be the one to say it. Thank you, Jeremy, for letting them know. But then also let me double down on that and say, yep, I've experienced that too. So it is truly a sigh of relief for people of color to be in this space. Then for folks who have more power and privilege, white folks, they're saying, you know what? I got some work to do, right? And that's a gift. Honestly, when I think about training, I've been a trainer for the last decade. And one of the things I've come to learn is that I don't want you to know something. I want you to do something. And what we need is folks with power and privilege to start doing. And so people walk away with not only affirmation and confirmation for folks who are marginalized, but also with information and a new thing that they can do, something that they can implement right away. And so folks are excited about that. It is 3 days. The first one, we build community. I've learned that people need to know who they're going to be on this learning journey with. And people also need to be comfortable enough to say cringy stuff and learn from it. There's going to be moments where people say some things and you're going, I can't believe it. I don't understand it. What are you talking about? But what I also expect is If you're going to share the information, be open to correction, be open to learning, right? And so at that first day, we play some icebreakers virtually. We explore some of those fundamental concepts. And then you're going to get some homework. That's right. You're going to get some stuff you can do to both reflect on that first day of community building, but prepare for the training. During the training, it is a fast-paced, in-your-face, engaging process where you're running through these scenarios. You're trying your best to win the game. And then after you've played the game, whether you lost the game or you won, you get a chance to talk to unpack those scenarios and talk more specifically about some tools you can use to intervene. And then the third day is critical because now we're saying, okay, we've built community, we've gone through the training. Is there a way for us to reflect on this and apply it to our lives and to our work? And so folks get a chance to talk about what they learned, how they feel, and what they're going to do differently later on. And then they get a guidebook that is 40 pages of content. You get interventionist strategies in the guidebook. You get definitions in the guidebook. You even get reflection questions in that guidebook as well. And so the full breadth of this training, all of it in every stage, does a great job to help people build community, learn new skills, and then take away something that they can use after they've left the training.
Well, I so appreciate your time this morning to describe to us the microaggressions that surround us every day and how we could begin to inform ourselves of how to address them in all those different ways that they may affect us. I appreciate Kelly, the Racine Women for Racial Justice, bringing this opportunity to us. As we've mentioned at the start of the show, the training actually started this morning as we are airing this program, but it is not too late for people to engage in the following 2 weeks. Kelly, could you tell them where to find it on the, I believe, on the website?
Yes, Laura, absolutely. And even today, at the start of the training, people are able to register today and jump in the training today as soon as it starts. So we want people to know that they can still register today on Saturday. And so they can find the link for the registration on our Facebook community page, Racine Women for Racial Justice. You can also find it on our website, which is www.rwrj, the acronym for Racine Women for Racial Justice, .com. And on there, you will also find the link. I also want people who may have difficulty finding the link, you know, email me if you need additional information. Our email is just like our name, Racine Women for Racial Justice at gmail.com. And so they have those ways to contact us or to register for this very, very, you know, I want to say valuable, but it's actually invaluable. There is no dollar amount that we could put on this type of training opportunity that we are receiving April 10th. April 17th and April 24th as we engage in this microaggressions training opportunity.
Thank you, Kelly. And I might reiterate that this is a free training offered to the community from all sectors of the community who want to be involved and understand more about how we interact with each other. Thank you so much for sharing some of that wisdom with us this morning. And I hope this won't be the last time that we have these discussions together as we try to all live better together. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura. Thanks for having us. And we look forward to people participating in the training.
Yeah, and thank you for inviting me, Kelly. And it's great to meet you, Laura.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, celebrate Earth Day and EcoFest Racine with drive-through activities on the campuses of Gateway, Saturday, April 17th from 9 until 11. While supplies last, pick up free garden kits, tree seedlings, kids' activities, and compost bags, and drop off unwanted electronics. Then from 11 to 1, activities, presentations, and workshops shift online. RSVP now for the online portion by going to Facebook. Search for Celebrate Earth Day and EcoFest Racine.
Join us on Saturday morning, April 17th at 11 a.m. for the rebroadcast of the WGTD Radio Theaters and on the 8th day, a look at the Scopes Monkey Trial, the Radio Theater, April 17th at 11 a.m.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, college students are eligible for food stamps through SNAP for up to $234 per month to help with groceries due to the pandemic. You don't have to work to be eligible, and students who receive no financial support and those who are eligible for work study should apply. Wisconsin.gov.
WGTD broadcasts from studios located on the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. In